Since it began in March, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has accelerated to the point that the death toll has now surpassed all previous outbreaks combined. At a special press conference yesterday, the head of the World Health Organization called the epidemic the largest, most severe, and most complex on record. The organization meets today to examine possible treatments. Midday on Health contributor Dr. John Smarr, an infectious disease expert, joins us to talk about Ebola, its spread, and the international response to it. Also, Suzanne Van Hull of Catholic Relief Services on dealing with affected African communities and on the fear the epidemic has inspired there. That's ahead on Midday after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us for the second hour of our show. At this hour, more than 100 scientists and industry executives are meeting in Geneva at the World Health Organization's headquarters. The subject of their meeting, the spiraling Ebola epidemic that since March has swept through West Africa. More than 3,500 cases of Ebola have been confirmed there, and more than 1,900 people have died. So far, the heart of the epidemic is in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, which together account for most of the cases. But the virus has also been detected in Nigeria and Senegal. And a separate strain of the virus has now been detected in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The WHO, the World Health Organization, estimates that before this epidemic is brought under control, more than 20,000 people could be infected. This week, WHO Chief Margaret Chan called this outbreak the largest, most severe, and most complex on record. And the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the window for controlling this Ebola epidemic is closing, and he's urging the global health community to act now before things become even worse. Here with us this hour to discuss the latest Ebola epidemic, the worst Ebola epidemic that we know of, and its ramifications, and the promise of a possible vaccine is John Smarr. John Smarr is a doctor at Sinai Hospital in Baltimore. He's a Midday contributor and a specialist in infectious disease. So this is right up his alley. Nice to have you back with us, John.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Boy, so much has happened since I saw you last, which was we weren't together last month because you were on vacation. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, this has the word spiral there is accurate for the growth of this. I wanted to start with a very simple question for our listeners to understand what Ebola is. From my reading, I understand that 40 years seems to be the only four decades of knowledge of this disease that we
right,
have.
Right. So this is not something that we've recognized as a problem with humans for a very, very long time. And it turns out there are several different types of this Ebola virus. And in fact, it's funny because whenever I'm driving around D.C. and I pass Reston, Virginia, one of the Ebola types is called Ebola Reston. And that has nothing to do with what's going on right now. But it was actually an infection that broke out in monkeys in a lab that never caused any sort of a human disease. But it's just that's a trigger thing whenever I'm driving in this area.
When you see that name, Reston.
Right, right. So, but what we're talking about is one of the other four types of Ebola. And this one that we're dealing with right now, of course, each type of the virus has different substrains and differences, and that can be very important from a scientific standpoint. But the one that we're dealing with now is the one that, and we've all seen the numbers in the news recently, where it's highly lethal in terms of its historical previous outbreaks. We're talking up to 90% in prior outbreaks of folks have died. And obviously, that is a devastating, devastating thing. It is important to note, though, that at least with the current numbers that we have from the WHO, and like you had said, something about 1,900 people have died. But based off the fact that it's something like just shy of 4,000 people that we have officially diagnosed as having had it, the current estimate is that 47% of folks who have gotten this have died. There's a lot of things that go into that number, though. Some of it is we're probably only seeing a tiny fraction of the cases of Ebola that are really out there in terms of this is just what we have documented for sure. The other piece is that when people are able to report for care earlier, and if they're able to get good supportive care for this infection, the statistical chances of them being able to get better from this and survive from it are much, much higher, which is part of the problem, of course.
So it's a virus, and when I say 40 years, I've seen references to Ebola's 40-year history. Does that mean it was first identified about 40 years ago?
Yes, yes. But our history, the history of the virus in terms of how long that we've known about it as a thing that we have defined. It's very likely that it has been around for significantly longer than that. And it may be that 40 years ago is when it actually made the jump from, as with many of these viruses, they're sort of naturally occurring in other animals. And so at some point, and we're even talking exotic things like Ebola up to even HIV. HIV jumped to humans, and we now think that that happened around 1900 or so, even though we didn't recognize it as being a problem in humans and characterize it until 80 years later in 1980 or 81. So it may be a similar thing here, but at least in terms of our own history of knowing this virus is a thing that's causing us problems, it's about 40 years or so.
Can you give us some idea about how the virus affects a human being, what the symptoms are, how it's transmitted?
Absolutely. And so if you look at the symptoms, really when people start getting sick with it, you really feel like you have a bad case of influenza almost, fevers, muscle aches, fatigue, sore throat, things like that. The problem that is, of course, is that it progresses on into other things. And you can have, of course, we now are sort of just calling it the Ebola virus, but it has been associated, and one of the names that was officially used in the past was a hemorrhagic fever, meaning that in addition to that, the Ebola virus will go to the small blood vessels, the capillaries, the tiny ones that are sort of at the ends of your blood tubes, and can cause those to destabilize, to break, and cause bleeding complications as well as everything else that the infection does. When someone is exposed to it, the numbers that everyone's hammering into everyone's head is that it's sort of 2 to 21 days is the amount of time that once you're exposed to it, that it can start incubating and you can become symptomatic from this virus. And essentially, with regards to not only making you feel awful and the bleeding complications, it can affect your body's system to such a degree that you go into a state of shock, and that's the real thing that ends up causing people, unfortunately, to die, and what makes them very, very sick and very, very weak, losing fluids, not able to maintain your blood pressure. And so that's why, up until we're talking about, say, the new experimental drugs or the vaccines that people are looking at, the best thing that we can do for those people is essentially pump them full of fluids, give them as much supportive care. If they're having difficulties breathing, maybe they need to go on a ventilator machine. And other than that, we haven't had a good direct treatment to directly target the virus and take it out, if it's a medicine, or a vaccine to prevent the virus from causing a problem in the first place.
Ebola is something that specialists in infectious diseases have been concerned with, certainly in the time you've been a doctor and have studied infectious diseases. What has happened in the past with outbreaks? How were they contained, and what were they limited to?
Right. And so a lot of the outbreaks that we previously know of are vaguely in the same region of Africa that we're talking about. And the big thing there is, again, how do these outbreaks start? And the thought is that this virus has a natural reservoir. It lives in non-humans. And the closest thing it's been tied to is the fruit bats or bats that are in that area. And of course, it can also infect primates as well, potentially. And so there's some thought that maybe someone, a human, might have picked it up either by being exposed to a fruit bat or being exposed to a primate, say, through the bushmeat trade. And then what happens, though, is that the humans then are able to pass it on to other people. In the past, the dynamics of the outbreaks have been small. And again, we're talking with any sort of epidemic, we're talking about multiple factors that are going into how bad it is, why it spreads to a certain extent in some cases and others. And at least in those cases, they ended up being very small. The biggest one before this was several hundred, 400, 500 people, if I'm remembering
died.
Correctly, who ended up dying from it. Yeah, correct. And it just, the I think that what we're looking at in terms of thinking about why is this one so bad, it's really hitting at a perfect storm of all of these different factors in terms of the countries that's popped up in, the circumstances that's popped up in, how interconnected areas are with regards to rural areas where folks can then take it into heavily populated centers, and the fact that we're looking at a healthcare system there that is so bare bones, that is so stripped down, hitting at a time when, and I know you had mentioned previously about a New York Times article looking at what the state of the WHO's funding is, that the response...
Oh, we tweeted out that story today that the Times had about the WHA being not in a position to do much here because of staffing cutbacks.
Right. Yeah. And so the level of money and infrastructure that can be brought to bear on this has been disproportionately low compared to the severity of the outbreak. Another piece of it is that this started back in March originally when this was a thing. And then there was a period of time after the initial few weeks where people really thought that this was dying out and that it wasn't a thing that we needed to escalate our level of attention for. And then it sparked up again, picked up again, spread to other countries. And at the end of the day, I think there's a number of complex factors that this is, there's a system that has a bunch of holes in it, and this is going straight through all the holes. There are issues with regards to education, how the native population is dealing with this from a cultural standpoint, from an education standpoint, that really has allowed this to spread to the degree that it has. And it's very likely not going to be under control anytime soon.
How does it spread, John?
It is spread via the virus itself, essentially gets into your body fluids. And so, for instance, being exposed to blood, being exposed to secretions from someone, let's say if they have the infection, if they cough and they were to cough droplets of fluid and you were to get that on you, that would be also a way that it would spread. There's also some suggestion even that it could be spread via sweat. And so the possible mechanism of that is that if the virus gets into the small capillaries and it's breaking through that, that it might leak into the sweat. And so any fluid that's coming from one, from someone, could be potentially infectious. The other piece, though, and this is probably the one sort of saving grace with regards to why this has not become a bigger issue, is unlike, say, respiratory virus, this is not something that we have seen that is easily able to be spread via aerosol. And when I use these two words, say I'm talking about coughing, in the medical world, if we're trying to protect people, do infection control things, we talk about droplets and we talk about aerosols. And droplets are, you cough, you've got your wet secretions,
right. Mm-hmm.
They spray out. But if I coughed, someone 20 feet away is not going to be exposed from that because those wet droplets that are coming out of my mouth with the cough or the sneeze are not going to make it that far. However, other infections, they're able to sort of last in the air longer and spread over a longer distance, and that's called an aerosol spread.
That's not the case with Ebola.
And that is not the case with Ebola. And in fact, there's a big debate, and we can maybe go into this later, among hospitals about, let's say, if this were to happen in the U.S., how much protection is enough to protect us from Ebola? Like, should we be just in case, if it does, on some random chance, if it's able to spread over long distances through the air? Other people argue, no, it can't, which seems to be the case. And so why get people's level of fear up that suddenly you're putting on special respirator masks instead of just being clothed from head to toe and all of the precautionary measures and regular masks and things like that?
Well, John Smarr is with us. Dr. Smarr is with us during this hour of midday. We welcome calls and questions about Ebola, 410-662-8780. The toll-free long-distance number, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And you can write a question by email if you want to go that way, midday@wypr.org. Before we take our first break, we'll take our first question from our listeners. This one from Janet in Pikesville. Janet, welcome to Midday on Health.
Hi, thank you. I have two questions, actually, and a third comment you may want to address. But anyway, the first question is, I heard on NPR about a college in Lynchburg, Virginia, screening students from West Africa by asking them to take their temperature twice a day. And I was wondering, is fever always the first symptom to show? And the second question is, once one has had Ebola and recovered from it, is one immune from that strain or other strains? And
okay, that's a lot there. Did you have one more comment?
Yeah, well, it was just about the family structure in Africa.
Well, let's deal with these three questions, Janet. That's a lot there for John just before our break, too. So let's go with this. We have heard about colleges being concerned about students coming for studies from that part of Africa, West Africa. Is fever always the first symptom? And if you recover from Ebola, are you therefore immune, John?
Right. And thanks, Janet. Those are both actually great questions
really. Okay.
And it's worthwhile noting that it's not just, even though thinking about colleges, absolutely, but even hospitals. For instance, Sinai, every hospital is concerned about the potential of travelers from that area. And so we sort of have screening protocols to set up. With every person, the chances is that the presenting symptoms they're going to have is going to be a little bit different. So it may not be, someone say may feel achy before they start having a fever, but it happens early enough that that is kind of a very rough, if you're going to pick one thing to try to screen people,
it's fever.
That seems like the best objective thing if you're trying to rule out someone who's coming from a high-risk area, but there's no guarantee.
As far as the college campus goes,
yeah,
and students from West African countries, you think this is prudent to do some screening, of at least for temperature, body temperature? Or
I think it's potentially reasonable, but I'm hedging because you're getting into the standpoint of it's different, say, if someone is feeling sick and is going to a healthcare facility, a hospital, mm-hmm, to get treated, as opposed to screening all the students who just came in. But I think that there is potentially an argument to be made for that. It's hard, and so I can see why people would have a level of concern that they would want to have some sort of screening before going into a crowded college situation, that if somebody had Ebola, then the potential for it easily being transmitted and causing an outbreak would certainly be there.
If you're unfortunate enough to become infected with Ebola, but fortunate enough to be in the 10% that recovers, what about Janet's question on immunity?
That is a stellar question. It's in part, the answer is that it's not necessarily the case that someone will become immune after they've been exposed to it. The other side is that we don't have great data, because it's not like we have a ton of people who have survived Ebola who have been studied with this particular strain, say, to do their blood samples afterwards to figure out if they make antibodies. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges, and we can talk about this when we mention vaccines, is that the Ebola virus is actually able, as ways that it has the structure of the virus, it's able to sort of evade detection by our immune system. So it's hard for our bodies to make antibodies to it. And so the people who are getting better may in part be developing antibodies, but the majority of that may be that we're just supporting them in terms of keeping them alive so that they can outlast the infection and the infection goes away. And there's not a lot of hard data or numbers to cite to figure that out, but I think that's the best answer to that.
Dr. John Smarr, who is a regular contributor here to Midday on Health, and a specialist in infectious diseases, joining us in this hour to talk about the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa. After this break, we'll be joined by Suzanne Van Hulle of Catholic Relief Services, which is based here in Baltimore. Of course, it's headquarters in Baltimore. Suzanne Van Hulle just returned from a trip to West Africa, where she oversaw Catholic Relief Services' Ebola response efforts. We'll be talking with her. If you have a question, this is a good time to call, 410-662-8780. This is Midday. Yeah, welcome back to Midday. Yes, we tweeted out, and I think you can find a link to this on my Facebook page today, the story the New York Times had yesterday about cuts at the World Health Organization and how that's affecting their response to the Ebola outbreak. A very interesting and troubling story. But, you know, a couple months ago we did a program and then re-aired the program about Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, and the work they've been doing in the place, I guess, of WHO or any other medical response organization. And they were right in these countries in West Africa, as well as Catholic Relief Services. Catholic Relief Services, of course, based here in Baltimore. And we have the pleasure of the company today of Suzanne Van Hulle, who has just spent some time in some of these countries in West Africa that's been affected by the Ebola outbreak. So, Suzanne, nice to have you on the show with us.
Yes, great to be here. Thank you very much.
What is your assignment with CRS? What do you do for CRS, and what countries did you visit?
So I'm actually a senior technical advisor for malaria, and so I support our countries around the world that have malaria programming. But with the outbreak in Ebola, it's been very intensive on our human resources. And so I've been brought in to look at coordinating a little bit our activities in the affected countries. So I was out in Senegal coordinating with our countries and speaking with them on a daily basis. And since I spent about 3 years living in Sierra Leone, this was a little bit my scope.
Okay. And CRS has a presence in which countries then? Senegal, Sierra Leone, also Guinea?
Or yes, Guinea. And then we work very closely with the Catholic Church in Liberia.
Now, I mentioned Doctors Without Borders. So what does CRS, what does your organization do in those countries under these circumstances with the Ebola outbreak?
Yeah, so whilst agencies as MSF work mainly on the clinical aspects of the outbreak, we look more at the community aspects. So a lot of working through our existing networks in terms of raising awareness on a lot of aspects that Dr. Smar talked about how it's transmitted, and also asking those that have been affected or families that have been affected to not stay at home and take care of the disease by themselves in a household, but really to work with the health centers and to call up doctors if they feel any symptoms. And so a lot of and then making sure that, you know, there's a lot of ideas about how it's transmitted and how it's, you know, not transmitted. So we do a lot of awareness raising.
So it's public education.
Yes.
You mean there's lots of stories and rumors about how it spread?
Exactly, yeah.
And so people need information. So that's the kind of work you've been doing.
Yes, we've been doing a lot of that, yeah, mainly. And also there's a big need now for health centers to be fully equipped with what we call personal protective equipment. Mm-hmm. And so we try and also work through, as I said, our Catholic health networks and Catholic health centers to give out a lot of these equipments so that that health workers can work under a safe environment and care for Ebola patients.
Does CRS recruit volunteers from each of the countries where it operates?
We have, so through our existing programming in both Guinea and Sierra Leone, we have very large malaria programming where we've worked with what we call community health workers. So they are volunteers within communities who are trained to deliver some of the messages. So now we're working with them to deliver messages on Ebola and also on other illnesses, because other illnesses are also being very much affected by this, as health centers are having a hard time coping with Ebola patients. And a lot of fear of communities not wanting to go to the health center anymore, this has a big effect on other illnesses.
The reason I ask about volunteers is because there's a story today from the Reuters News Service about the difficulty in getting an adequate number of volunteers in each of these countries to help with exactly what you're talking about, providing those services.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
people are afraid.
Exactly.
It's fear, right?
Yes, I think.
Don't blame them.
Yeah, we don't blame them. I think this is, you know, a very new disease for all of us, whether you're in West Africa or whether you're in the U.S. So I think it's difficult, yes, finding people who want to come on board on this.
Yes, John, I mean, convincing someone who wants to come on board, willing to come on board, to volunteer in this situation, you have to convince them of what? That adequate clothing, adequate coverage of your body will keep you at lower risk?
Yeah, that's the biggest thing, is convincing people that this is that going into this situation that they are going to be personally safe. I mean, that's the biggest thing. And some people will have a low degree of threshold to say, you know what, I trust that this all is going to be fine. And I think a big case in point in terms of folks trusting that with all the protective equipment that we're using works is in part the fact that we had two folks that were brought into Emory University in Atlanta. Now, granted, they have a special infectious diseases sort of quarantine unit, but they followed all these same protocols, only they just had the greater resources to be able to do it than other places in Africa. And so it's clear that no one there, none of the healthcare workers there got infected, which is outstanding. And it's just overcoming sort of that barrier and that hesitation. I remember reading one of the articles that there was one of the doctors, I think it was from the SIM group, mm-hmm. showed up, and essentially their first question was, where is everybody? Meaning, where are all the doctors and nurses and healthcare providers feeling like they would have expected a greater response? And I suspect that lots of people have concerns about walking into that situation. And so that's a barrier that even healthcare workers and responders to care for people have to overcome to be able to get there.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. If you have a question for either of our guests, Dr. John Smarr or Suzanne Van Hulle of Catholic Relief Services. I've read reports in some communities where people feel trapped, as if they're under quarantine. I wonder if you've had any experience with that. And I also wonder if there's been any issue of refugees resulting from the Ebola outbreak, people actually leaving villages.
I think in terms of the quarantine aspect, that creates a lot of fear. Quarantine means in certain instances, as in Liberia and one of the slum areas outside of Monrovia, the whole area is guarded by armed police and the army, and that creates huge amount of fear. You can just imagine having the police around your neighborhood. You can't go out, you can't go and buy food. You know, there's a lot of limitations around that aspect, so it does create a lot of fear.
And given the level of fatality resulting from Ebola, it's as if to say, well, you're going to die here, so we have to quarantine you in this spot. That's the message you could construe from that.
Right, and this is why, again, it's very important that the right messages are sent to everyone around that it's really for people's health and well-being, not only for individuals that might be affected, but also for everyone around them, their family and their neighbors.
And that's that's a key thing. It's one of the hardest things about this, and this is extrapolates into any sort of public health thing, that at the end of the day, it's not just about the person who is sick, but it's the concern over who else might be exposed. And so some might make a sort of human freedoms and rights argument of, we're saying you can't go anywhere because there is a very high likelihood that you could spread it to other people. And any person is going to have a naturally negative reaction to that. And so it's making sure the right messages are sent, like you said, mm-hmm. making sure that people have all the right sort of education to understand the importance of why this is being done. But still, you're working against things like, there's armed guards, it's military, and it's raising levels of anxiety and fear and suspicion.
Let's take a phone call, 410-662-8780. Again, our number, if you have a question about Ebola, for John Smarr, Dr. Smarr, or Suzanne Van Hulle of Catholic Relief Services, who just returned from a trip to the countries affected by this in West Africa. Sam in Reisterstown, we'll take your question next. Hello.
Hello there.
Hi, Sam.
So my question is about the story that came out of the hospital in West Africa that was attacked, and all the supplies were removed from it for one reason or another. My question is, in light of trying to control the outbreak, how long do these things remain infectious if they're not carefully controlled, if they're like misused for whatever reason?
How long does it live, basically, right?
Right.
On what? a hospital bed or...
Yeah, like soiled linens, something like that. That's a good question, Sam. Thank you for asking. And it's a hard one to answer in part because, again, fortunately, people have not done a lot of studies on that type of a thing. Now, it's theorized, and from what we know is that from an obvious standpoint, so Ebola is not going to be able to survive, say, for days, say, if it got on this table. And so I think the rule of thumb is that if the body fluid is, if it's still moist, like if someone sweat or bled onto a linen and it's still moist, then that would be something to be avoided. Likely, if it had been completely dry, and it's been completely dry for a number of hours, it's probably fine. But the problem is that, again, we don't know for sure, and it depends on every, and as with any virus, trying to figure out would it stay alive on a surface, you're talking about temperature, you're talking about humidity, you're talking about other environmental factors that may increase or decrease that. But I think the best rule of thumb that people are following is that if something is still wet with a body fluid, then it must be treated as absolutely contagious.
Okay, thank you, John. Here's a question by email from Jennifer, who's wondering about taking a trip to Africa. If you had a pleasure trip planned in October for another part of Africa, not Liberia, would you go?
So I can answer. I was going to let Susanna answer first.
All right. Please go ahead.
Well, it was interesting. So you mentioned earlier, I was just on vacation. I wasn't going to Africa, but we went over to England and Scotland. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, things had not spread to the degree that we had a month ago. But still, it was concerning of still trying to answer these questions of what are the chances that whether or not you're going to Africa or going to a different country outside of the United States, what are the chances that someone who didn't know that they had Ebola would get on the plane, make it to that other country, and expose people? And one of the answers is that, for instance, in Europe, the place that people are most concerned about is France, because a lot of connections with regards to family and other interests between France and that area of Africa. My answer would be that I would pay very close attention to the news, and I would still go, and I would probably have most of my relatives giving me crazy, crazy looks at that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's challenging, and it would depend, I would say, based on what you're actually going to do on that trip. So, for instance, if you were going to a different African country, especially one that's not contiguous with the ones that are affected, and you're going to stay mainly within a city, you're not going out into rural areas. Now, being in a city is not going to protect you necessarily, but it's probably going to decrease your likelihood that if you're just going, say, to a conference in a big city and you're always going to be in the confines of this hotel or sightseeing at certain places, I would say the likelihood is lower. But still, there are some folks who would probably wave off all travel to Africa. The flip side of that, and a big part of this problem, is, again, it gets back to getting people to come into those areas to be able to help and manage the outbreak. And so it's a risk-benefit thing. Hmm. So I would still go, especially if it was more of a contained experience that I was having. But if someone was, say, going out and they're going to go on, say, safari or go out and do something in the more rural areas, then maybe I would have a higher level of suspicion, and I probably would hedge on the side of not taking that trip.
What about the travel itself, being inside an airplane, making that trip on a passenger jet for 7 or 8 hours or however long it takes, especially on the return trip, not knowing who your companions are?
Exactly.
Traveling companions are.
Right. And so the biggest thing, again, would be to go back to, as we talked about before, this is not a airborne spread virus. So let's say that you were on the front of the plane and someone in the back of the plane, it turns out, had Ebola. And this has already happened earlier in the outbreak of these type of incidents. They're going to screen everyone who is on the plane, but the likelihood of you getting it would be very low because it's not like the droplets are floating about. But certainly if someone is, now the problem is that I'm in the profession where I am askance if I'm on a bus or a plane and someone starts coughing or something that's nearby me, and that is something that would probably concern me. But I wanted to hear about your answer to the travel question.
Someone asked you because you just returned from there. They know what the nature of your work, so they have a trip planned to another part of Africa, say South Africa or Eastern Africa.
Yeah, I just want to say also that the World Health Organization has not put any travel restrictions on any kind of air travel. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that that, you know, refers to what Dr. Smar was talking about, that the transmission in a flight is very, very low. So I think that's something to note. I think now if the person is going outside of West Africa, the likelihood again of transmission is just very low. I think a lot of these other countries, you know, have perhaps more robust health systems and infrastructures in general. There's a lot of checks going on, and there's been a lot of, you know, airlines that have canceled their trips in and out of all these affected countries. So, you know, the likelihood that now somebody else, you know, leaves the country and gets in another affected country by air is low. But
I'm just curious, if have you had any of your staff or volunteers or people who work with CRS express concern about continuing to work in these environments?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's difficult, but this is the nature a little bit of our work. Mm-hmm. So we do place our number one priority is staff and security. So if anybody has any kind of, you know, is fearful and doesn't want to work in these areas, then we'll definitely evacuate them. And we've actually evacuated all our non-essential staff and dependents from all affected countries.
You mentioned malaria before, so this is quite a distraction from your work on malaria, right?
That's right.
You can only do so much.
Yes, that's right.
Suzanne Van Hulle of Catholic Relief Services with us in the studio, along with Dr. John Smar. We're talking about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. 410-662-8780. When we get back, we should talk about the effort to find a vaccine. There's that, and the concern about it spreading and continuing here. 410-662-8780 if you have a question for us. Yeah, the World Health Organization, a summit today in Geneva to discuss the outbreak of Ebola. John Smar, Dr. Smar, a question for you about vaccines. We've seen news reports about the work on this. What's the latest on that?
Well, there's a couple of things to talk about there. We can talk about both the vaccine development and also medications to treat Ebola, because we already now
have... Let's do that first, then.
Yeah, that would make more sense.
Let's talk about medications.
So, and these all have great names, so get ready. So the medicine that so far we've heard about that, for instance, was given to the Americans who came back, it's a medicine called ZMAP. That's the name, and it's made by MAP Pharmaceuticals, which I think is something to do with the name. And essentially, it's a mixture of three different antibodies that they derived from other drugs or other areas that can specifically target Ebola. And the challenge, as I said before, with our body responding to try to take care of Ebola on its own is that the virus is structured so, the easiest way to say it, is that it's hard for our own antibodies to come in, for our own body to recognize it and make our own antibodies. But that doesn't mean that once we actually have antibodies in our system, that our immune system can't deal with it. So this drug is essentially injecting antibodies into the system to take care of it. It doesn't give you immunity. These are not going to stay in your system for a long time. Now, this is something where apparently now they are sort of out of the drug. Like I saw a story today where the company actually has a shortage of the drug, but a couple of days ago they got a $2 million grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to this company did to make more of this drug. They've tested it in monkeys, and in this monkey trial that was published a few days ago in Nature, they found that this drug can actually, infected 21 monkeys with Ebola, 18 of them they gave this drug to, all 18 survived, and in fact, they were very sick, and so things like they were already having bleeding problems, they were having their liver was affected, and all of the monkeys recovered.
Wow.
But the three, of course...
Is that a wow?
So yes, that was an absolute wow. Now, the flip side of this is so far, 7 humans have gotten this drug, and unfortunately, 2 of those people did die. And so it's hard to say about those circumstances. There are also other medicines that are being looked at, and hopefully there is some promise that we'll have something. And if there's time, we can talk about the logistics of that.
What about the promise of a vaccine?
Right. So there are two vaccine candidates that are the most promising that companies are looking at. And again, they have sexy names. One is called, I'm not even going to say the names because it's going to be a garbage of letters.
That's okay.
Which is fine.
You said they were sexy.
Yes, they are. Okay. They're sexy letters. So, but essentially the theory behind the two vaccines is that they've taken another virus that isn't going to cause us any problems, and they've taken pieces of the gene structure of Ebola and grafted them onto this virus. And so they're going to inject this into us, and our body will see this and make antibodies to the Ebola chunks, because now it's on a virus where our immune system can actually find it. That's the basic theory.
You know, every time you describe that, you've described this before about how a vaccine works. It always seems counterintuitive to me. Still, I mean, I've learned.
I understand. Yeah, absolutely.
I've studied it. I think I do understand it. But it always, on some level, it seems like that sounds dangerous. It sounds like just the opposite of what you should be doing.
Right. But so with these two, so where are we at with this? So one of them has been proven that it works in non-human primates. And the other one has some data like that and is about to enter phase one trials. So there are ways that you do trials. And very generally, the concern, and this is something that people have talked a lot about, is that normally when you're doing vaccines or medications, the trial process takes forever. It needs to have a lot of patients be involved. And typically, it requires a lot of paperwork to be able to do. And these are not things that are at all conducive to the situation in that area of Africa. The few medical professionals there, for instance, should not be wasting their time doing paperwork to do trials. They should be doing what they can to treat patients. And so essentially, logistically, WHO, CDC are working with the pharmaceutical companies to essentially try to fast track these in a streamlined way to see if we can actually get something out very soon. Because the challenge is that this, like I said before, it does not look like this is going to end anytime soon.
Dr. John Smarr is Assistant Director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Sinai Hospital here in Baltimore, and he's the Program Director of Sinai's Internal Medicine Residency Program. He joins us once a month for Midday on Health. Suzanne Van Hulle is with Catholic Relief Services. And Suzanne, the other day I was talking with someone who was not born in the United States. This person was reflecting on the comfort level of life in the United States. And in thinking about the Ebola outbreak, considering countries like Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Senegal, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, I've never been there. I've only seen pictures and talked to people who've been to, visited these countries. And we know that life is tough anyway, even without Ebola, an outbreak of this deadly disease. I'm wondering how this has affected life. Could it make life even worse for people who live in the small villages or even the larger towns and cities in these countries? Your perspective on that, I'd find interesting.
Yeah, I think there's kind of the short-term impacts that we're seeing now that we're reading about right now. There's also kind of medium and long-term impacts. I think right now for children, it's very tough because schools have been closed in Sierra Leone until December 2014. And with WHO saying that this outbreak might last another 6 to 9 months from now, this could mean, you know, closure of schools for an entire year. Hopefully not. But that is a probability, and so that's really impacting life in these countries. Nigeria has also.
Excuse me. Do you think that I want to speak for the folks that who are there on the scene dealing with this, but is that a wise caution, a wise decision to actually close schools in this situation? I'm curious what John Smarr thinks about that.
I think from the standpoint, again, we're getting into likelihoods of spread. We're getting into issues with people's fear, and it's like fear almost of everything, because you have issues with there's some people culturally, superstitiously, are believing that say the U.S. or other countries are bringing Ebola in. Some people are tying it with witchcraft. Some people may have a really good understanding of it and don't want their kids to actually go to school because they're concerned about the risk. And I think legitimately, especially in more rural areas or when you have students who are coming in from more rural areas, the risk is high enough. Again, we have the numbers that we have, but the WHO is estimating it is much, much bigger in terms of the number of people who are actually affected than we know. So I think overall, from the standpoint of trying to contain things and keep people healthy, it makes sense. But the flip side is it might be working against some educational efforts. Actually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Kids home from school for perhaps a whole year. So there are these other ways that daily life is affected there. Daily life already a struggle for so many people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another area is around food security and food shortages. You know, the planting season was in around July and August, and that's when, you know, a lot of the cases were increasing, and that's when the countries declared health emergencies. And so a lot of the planting season was not able to occur with families being affected. So we may see in the long term some food shortages, which also is another worry for these countries.
John, here's a question for you that goes back to the discussion we just had about vaccination, the promise of a vaccination or medical treatment. This is from Zachary. He says, it seems to me that Ebola vaccination or treatment research has been underfunded by the unlikelihood of its victims being able to afford to make the treatment profitable for pharmaceutical companies. Do you believe this is the case? And how do we wrestle with the ethical implications of that sort of capitalism?
That is a great question. And I would say that the more likely factor is less a little bit from what you say, Zach, but more so because ignoring this epidemic. Now, we have a total number of people, as was reported today, who have died that is greater than all the previous outbreaks of Ebola combined. And a bigger part of that, but relates to that, is that if it's such a rare disease that doesn't happen so often, and again, ignoring the current outbreak, then there's going to be very little reason for a pharmaceutical company to invest in making a vaccine that may never, ever be used. And again, it has to do with cost, but simultaneously, whatever aspersions you can lay on the business, and we've talked multiple times on this program before about how it's not evil, it's just business, and we can disagree with that, but sadly, that's the way the structure exists for. I think this, obviously, this is proof positive that thinking previously in terms of at least how much this is needed is wrong, and hopefully we'll overcome these other cost and capitalist incentives or reasons why drug companies and pharmaceutical companies do not push making vaccines or drugs that are not used wisely. It's the whole thing of there's far more money in a company making a cholesterol-lowering medicine they can sell everybody to take every day than even in any vaccine, which somebody might get once or twice in their life. And then you're talking with this about a much, 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 in theory, smaller population of somebody's. So yeah, there's absolutely an economic reason into that too, but I think it does tie into the relative rarity of the disease. But that thinking, obviously, has just been appropriately broken in light of this epidemic.
And this epidemic is going to be around for a while, John.
You don't see it abating
anytime soon? Predictions about it spreading up to 20,000 people infected, you think are realistic?
I think it's realistic, and it all ties into what Susanna was talking about with infrastructure stuff. The infrastructure is the reason it spreads so much, and that's going to be an issue with it continuing to spread.
Dr. John Smarr from Sinai Hospital, thanks for being here again, John.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and Suzanne Van Hulle, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here, for the work you do. And I'll tell folks, if you have time, please go to the Catholic Relief Services website and see the work that they do in not just these countries, but all around the world, and based here in Baltimore.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
It was nice to meet you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. On behalf of our staff here at WYPR, we thank you for listening. And please come back again tomorrow. We'll see you for another show soon enough. Have a great afternoon.